So we're looking tonight at Genesis chapter 1, verses 3 to 13. And one word that we used quite a bit last week is the word process. I said that God in the beginning didn't make his creation all that he wanted it to be instantaneously. No, he initially brought into being something rather unimpressive, actually. Something which verse 2 says was without form and void. And it was only after he'd done that then that he started to arrange and order his creation so that it was no longer without form, and that he started to fill his creation so that it was no longer void. And that's the process then that's outlined for us throughout Genesis chapter 1. And it's outlined for us in terms of 6 days. 6 days of God arranging and filling his formless and void creation, followed by a 7th day, which is completely different. And our passage then this evening covers the first 3 of those days. Why, you may ask, group the first 3 together? Why not the first 2 or the first 4 or something? Well, there is some logic in my approach. Let me try to explain. Day 1 describes the creation of light. Day 2 describes the waters below, that is, seas, rivers, and lakes, being separated from the waters above, that is, the clouds, by means of an expanse, i.e. the sky. And then day 3 describes the dry land being formed and made inhabitable. What then happens is this. Days 4, 5, and 6 revisit each of the areas of creation covered in days 1 to 3, and in the same order. So day 4 revisits the light created on day 1, and now certain things are put in place that will convey and channel that light. Day 5 revisits the stuff of day 2, the waters below and the expanse above those waters. The waters below are now populated with creatures, and the expanse, the sky, is now stocked with birds. And then day 6 revisits the dry land formed on day 3. And those creatures that will inhabit the dry land are now brought into being. In other words, these 6 days of creative activity are kind of 2 cycles. Days 1 to 3, days 4 to 6. And what we're doing this evening then is looking at the first cycle. And as we do so, let me highlight for you a few things. And first of all, the genius. The genius. I suppose we often associate God's creative activity with power, understandably and appropriately so. There'd be something seriously amiss, wouldn't there, if we weren't struck by the sheer power of the Creator God here. But it seems to me that if there's one thing about God that is just as striking in Genesis 1 as his boundless strength and his sheer potency, it's his mind. I mean, what kind of mind conceived of a creation like this? Suppose there's a really original and innovative artist or architect. Someone who isn't dictated by the methods of the past. Someone who comes at things freshly and thinks about art or about architecture in new ways and takes it in new directions. We might say, well, it's as if that person is working with a blank sheet. No givens encumbering him or her, just a clean slate, a blank sheet. And there's some validity in that kind of language. We get the point that's been made there, don't we? But really, of course, there's no such thing as a blank sheet. Every artist and every architect, however pioneering and trailblazing he or she might be, is in fact constrained by countless givens. The fact that this is a material universe rather than an immaterial one. The fact that sight and visibility exist. The fact that there are colours. The fact that there is gravity. The fact that there are solids and there are liquids. And on and on and on we could go. Every artist and every architect is working within those fixed and predetermined parameters. But here's the thing. God wasn't. God truly had a blank sheet. He didn't have to comply with a whole load of givens. No, he came up with all the givens that everyone else has now to comply with. Everything that to us is a given was a free choice to him. There wasn't some external necessity dictating that this universe be a material one, or that sight and visibility should exist, or that colour should exist, or gravity should exist, or solids and liquids should exist. None of those things had to be. Matter and visibility and colour and gravity and solids and liquids, they aren't these eternal non-negotiables that just had to feature in any universe that God might decide to create. No, they exist simply because God chose to style his universe along those lines. And if he hadn't chosen to style his universe along those lines, if he had chosen to style his universe along completely different lines, matter and visibility and all the rest would never have existed. Perhaps I'm just weird, but I find such thoughts mind-blowing. I mean, consider those words there in verse 3. Let there be light. Let there be light. And it isn't, I suppose, dissimilar from something that you or I might say. So you're trying to do some job or other, and the room that you're in is somewhat dark and dingy, and you need to be able to see properly in order to do this job. And so you say to the person who's with you, "Can I have some light, please?" And on the face of things, as I say, it's not all that different from what God says here in verse 3, except, of course, that it is. It's hugely different. When you say, "Can I have some light, please?" you say that because light is a thing. It's a concept which predates you saying those words. It's something, indeed, to which you were introduced, first of all, many years earlier when you emerged from the darkness of your mother's womb into some brightly lit maternity ward. When God says, "Let there be light here," it isn't just that at that moment his universe lacks light, the way that that room where you're doing your job lacks light. No, when God says, "Let there be light," there isn't even a concept of light. It would be like you doing that job in that room, saying to your companion, "I need a flying zebra, please. Can you just get me a flying zebra?" And your companion would look at you in total bewilderment, because a flying zebra isn't a thing. Except that God's words here are even crazier than that, because at least zebras are a thing. And flying is a thing, but nothing whatsoever about light is a thing. God is calling here for something that has quite simply never existed before, even as an idea, even as a notion, even as a concept. And yet he calls for this thing that has no previous existence, knowing exactly what it is that he intends. Most of you will be familiar with a slinky. It's a spring toy that you can do lots of entertaining tricks with. And it rose, I guess, to new levels of fame through the Slinky Dog in the Toy Story movies. But two things are interesting about the invention of the Slinky. Number one, Richard James, who invented it, was an evangelical Christian who later went on to serve with Wycliffe Bible Translators in Bolivia. And number two, he never set out to invent a toy. He was, in fact, a naval engineer trying to remedy a very specific problem. When a naval ship was in rough seas, its important instruments could easily fall off the surfaces that they were placed on and break. And Richard James then was experimenting with ways of stopping this. And he would attach the instruments to this extendable spring that he had developed. And it was while he was developing this device that he suddenly realized what he had come up with here. He had come up with something that kids would love to play with, a toy that would keep them occupied for hours on end. Nothing like that is going on in Genesis 1. God doesn't experiment a bit with his creative powers here, trying this and trying that, and suddenly he has a eureka moment where he realizes he's come up with something pretty cool. Yeah, I like that, what I've just made there.
Maybe I'll call it light, actually. And I reckon that that could add something quite beneficial to this universe that I'm in the process of creating. It's not like that at all, is it? These creation days don't end, each of them, with God kind of making sense of that day's activity. Well, I think that could be useful, and yeah, I don't know, that might have a role somewhere. Instead, each day begins with God articulating precisely what he's now going to form. Let there be light. Let the dry land appear. Let the earth sprout vegetation. And already then, he has these things fully fledged in his own mind. Light and dry land and vegetation, even though none of them has ever existed in any sense at all before. It's just amazing. I mean, think of the trees that he calls for there in verse 11. Aren't trees just the most fantastic things? We find shade under trees. We eat the fruit from trees. Birds nest in trees. We climb trees when there's a famous teacher in town and we're not quite tall enough to see him above the crowd. At a deeper level, we just connect somehow, don't we? Emotionally almost, with trees, so that the felling of that old tree in Sycamore Gap prompted an almost international, or definitely an international, outpouring of grief. And God then, without any prototypes, without any pre-existing concept of treeness from which to derive inspiration, he just says, I want there to be trees. Where did that come from? Well, this is where it came from. It came from this breathtakingly creative mind. It came from the infinite genius of the living God. It should make us all want to fall on our faces in worship. But we must move on. The genius, secondly, this evening, the gusto. The gusto. So the creation account is full of refrains, lines that are repeated over and over again. You cannot possibly miss that. And one of my favorites is that line, God saw that it was good. God saw that it was good in terms of the days of creation that we're looking at this evening, these first 3 days. It's there once, that refrain, on day one. It's not there at all on day two, prompting one commentator to remark, tongue-in-cheek, even God didn't say that Mondays are good. And it's there twice on day three. Now, it's very important to be aware that good here, then, it does not mean unmarred by sin. It does not mean unmarred by sin. Now, of course, every part of the creation is unmarred by sin at this point. That's absolutely certain, but that's not what this refrain is about. If it were, if this goodness that keeps being commented on, if it equates to being unmarred by sin, then it's a fleeting goodness, isn't it? It's a goodness that lasts only until chapter 3, and which then, with the entrance of sin into the creation, disappears, leaving the world no longer good. But that's not the case. We know that this is not a fleeting goodness. We know it because many centuries later, the Apostle Paul, writing to his young friend Timothy, clearly takes up the language of this refrain in Genesis 1. And he says to Timothy, everything God created is good. 1 Timothy 4, verse 4. Everything God created is good. Not everything God created was good, but sadly it's bad now. No, he indicates there that the creation has retained its original Genesis 1 goodness. It's permanently and unalterably good. And I think it's helpful then to probe the context there in 1 Timothy 4. Paul mentions there some false teachers who are anti-food and who are anti-marriage. Ascetics, I guess we might call them. They regard the physical and all the pleasures of the physical realm as dubious and unhealthy and distracting. And so according to their outlook, Christians should loosen their ties as much as possible with this earth and prioritize meditation and prayer and the things of the soul. And Paul in that passage is saying to Timothy, don't you listen to those guys, Timothy.
Don't you listen to those guys. Remember Genesis chapter 1, where God creates a full-bloodedly physical universe. And he doesn't create it deviously, kind of laying a trap to ensnare us poor human beings so that we'll enjoy this world with it, this earth with its store of wonders untold, as we sang just now, and he'll then judge us for doing so. He doesn't do it in that kind of spirit. Nor does he create the universe reluctantly, just for some reason, making a full-bloodedly physical universe, even though his heart's not really in it. No, Timothy, Paul is saying, he creates it with gusto, stopping every day of creation week, or almost every day of creation week, exclaiming, wow, wow, it's good, it's good. So don't be taken in, Timothy, Paul is saying. Don't concede an inch to those false teachers obsessed with spirituality, obsessed with soul things. Revel in matter, Timothy. Revel in soil and stone and skin, Timothy. Revel in touch and taste and sight, Timothy. Everything God created is good. And that message is for us, as well as for Timothy. Never be embarrassed as a Christian about enjoying the physicality of this world and all its delightful physical pleasures. God isn't embarrassed. You sense here, don't you, his relish and his enthusiasm for it all. You remember how C.S. Lewis, in his book The Magician's Nephew, describes Aslan creating Narnia. And how does Aslan do it? He does it by singing. He sings that world into existence. And Genesis 1 then doesn't portray it quite like that, or at least not at this point. Perhaps later in the chapter there's something a bit more directly comparable. But even though here in our passage God creates through prose commands rather than through song, it's every bit as clear as it is in C.S. Lewis's tale that this creative work is not done wearily by God. And it's not done half-heartedly by God. Because we have a creator here who almost can't bring anything into existence without then interjecting the G word. Good! It's so good! He might as well be singing, I'm saying. The atmosphere in which he creates is rapturous. There's real gusto as he does it here. Listen to what John Calvin says about the saw that it was good refrain. He says, here God is introduced by Moses as surveying his work that he might take pleasure in it. Therefore, Calvin continues, nothing remains for us but to acquiesce, that is to agree, in this judgment of God. He says, man ought to apply all his senses, strong language, man ought to apply all his senses to the admiring contemplation of the works of God. And by the works of God there, he means creation. And so let me ask you, as John Calvin isn't here this evening to ask you, let me ask you, do you apply all your senses to the admiring contemplation of God's creation? Are you acquiescing fully in God's verdict? It is good. It is good. It is good. Later on, actually, Calvin goes on to talk about the subject of astronomy. And this is what he says. He says, astronomy isn't only pleasant, but also very useful to be known. It cannot be denied that this art unfolds the admirable wisdom of God. Wherefore, as ingenious men are to be honoured who have expended useful labour on this subject, so they who have leisure and capacity ought not to neglect this kind of exercise. Do you have leisure and capacity? Well, Calvin would say, if you do, you should be getting into astronomy. You should be interested in the stars. You should be interested in the night sky, because it's good. And God's, it is good, it is good, it is good. That should compel us to get our hands dirty with this wondrous creation. Do you remember what we sang a few minutes ago in Psalm 111? Great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them? Do you delight in the works of the Lord that he created with such gusto? Do you study them? Do you enjoy them? Don't be awkwardly embarrassed as a Christian about your relationship to the physical universe. It's God's physical universe. It's your Father's world. Enjoy what he made with gusto. The genius, the gusto. Thirdly, this evening, the gulf. The gulf. But you might ask, is there not a danger then of getting too into the creation, whereby we almost deify it and become guilty of idolatry? Well, yes, that danger can exist. And it's helpful then at this point, I think, to remember what Calvin reminded us of in one of those quotes just now, that Moses was the original author of this text. Moses wrote the first five books. Moses wrote Genesis. Moses wrote Genesis 1. And for whom then in the first instance was he writing this? Well, obviously, like every biblical writer, those of his own generation, the Israelites, that is, who had come out with him from Egypt. And in Egypt, of course, those Israelites had been exposed to Egyptian religion. And Egyptian religion involved the worship of all sorts of things, including then all sorts of components of the physical universe, and especially the sun. Like many other civilizations throughout history, the Egyptians worshipped the sun. And so Moses then, having himself had an Egyptian upbringing, and having lived in that environment for so much of his life, Moses knows very well the danger of deifying the creation. And one of the goals then in his creation account here is to drive nail after nail into the coffin of worshipping the creation. The most obvious and famous example of this is the way in which he belittles the sun by not properly naming it. There in verse 16, he just refers to the sun as one of two great lights, and it's the greater light then that rules the day. This thing that's worshipped by the Egyptians, worshipped by so many nations, Moses doesn't even bother giving it a name. And you might be thinking, well, okay, Dan, that's interesting, but you're kind of straying here beyond this evening's text. That's in the next episode. And that's true. But while that belittling of the sun may belong in the next passage, there is, I think, another belittling of the sun that's going on here in Genesis 1 that is relevant to this evening's passage. Let's just stand back a moment and ask the question, why has the sun so often been deified? And I guess partly it's just its sheer visual impressiveness, isn't it? I mean, the sun is just extraordinarily impressive visually, almost unmatched by anything else, I guess, in all of creation. At the minute when I set off to walk here on a morning, the sun is very low in the sky, and walking out of Reynolds Avenue, I can't see it. Walking along Killingworth Drive, I can't see it. But then I get to the roundabout at the top of Park Terrace, where Paul and Naomi used to live, and suddenly I see the sun, and though it happens every morning, I still kind of gasp every time. It's just there, and it's so enormous, and it's so bright, and it's so astonishing. So that's one reason why human beings have worshipped the sun, because it's so visually impressive, but also, of course, because it's so necessary. I mean, everything depends on this source of energy and heat and light, and there's something, I suppose, very godlike then about that degree of necessity and that degree of dependence by everything else on it. And that then may be why one of those things that I just mentioned then, energy, heat, light, actually in creation precedes the sun, doesn't it? By 3 days. Light in our text, day one. The sun, next time's text, day four. And Calvin then, again, comments on this. And he writes these words. He says, "To nothing are we more prone than to tie down the power of God to those instruments, the agency of which he employs. He says, the sun and moon supply us with light. And in our notions, we so include this power to give light in them that if they were taken away from the world, it would seem impossible for any light to remain. Therefore, the Lord, by the very order of the creation, bears witness that he holds in his hand the light, which he is able to impart to us without the sun and moon. We may learn from the order of the creation itself that God acts through the creatures. So he works through the sun and the moon, not as if he needed external help, but just because it was his pleasure, thus says Calvin. And so I'm saying then, yes, there is a danger. There has always been a danger. And many civilizations in this world show us the danger of deifying the creation. But here within the creation account itself, we have these safeguards. And we have these helps that we won't deify the creation. The sun, later on, as we've said, just being belittled, just a title that's very functional. But then also what is here in our text, the way in which light precedes the sun, showing that the sun actually isn't as necessary as we might think it is. God can work outside the sun if he wants to work outside the sun. He can bypass the sun if he wants to bypass the sun. Because God is God, the sun isn't God. That's the point. And one other thing then, in this connection to help us to preserve this gulf between God and his creation. There are helps within the text itself, but we've already mentioned 1 Timothy 4:4, which is clearly alluding so much to Genesis 1. For everything God created is good, Paul writes to Timothy. But he doesn't stop there. He continues, and nothing is to be rejected, marriage, food, the things the false teachers were rejected, if it is received, I'm quoting the NIV here, it's probably similar in the ESV, with thanksgiving. If it is received with thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is the thing, isn't it, that preserves our appreciation and enjoyment of the creation from idolatry. If we're enjoying the creation with thanksgiving, we're by definition not being idolatrous. Idolatry is where we enjoy the creation and forget altogether that it's come from someone above the creation, it's come from God. But if we're enjoying the creation with thanksgiving, enjoying our food and drink, enjoying the sunsets, enjoying the plants, enjoying the seasons, enjoying everything with thanksgiving to God, if you see that sun on a morning on your walk to work and you see it and you go, wow, thank you, Lord, for this, that's not idolatry. That then is using the creation, enjoying the creation as we should enjoy it. And so let's make sure then that we preserve the gulf. That yes, we have a godlike gusto in our enjoyment of creation, but we do that preserving the gulf between creator and creation. And we can preserve that gulf best by enjoying it always, always, always with conscious thanksgiving. The genius, the gusto, the gulf. Fourthly and finally this evening, the glimpse. The glimpse. Now we all know what is going to happen to this creation that we see emerging here in Genesis chapter 1. We said, very importantly, I reiterate, that it's not going to lose its intrinsic goodness. There is a goodness that God is commenting on in this refrain that has never gone away. But of course, something is going to happen to the creation. In Paul's language elsewhere in Romans 8, it's going to be subjected to frustration. In that same passage, it's going to be put in bondage to decay. In the language of Genesis 3 itself, it's going to be placed under a curse. And that's all tragic. But thankfully, of course, it's not the end of the story. And there is going to be, to use Paul's language again, and he uses this phrase twice in his letters, there is going to be one day a new creation. When? when is there going to be a new creation? Well, instinctively we answer at the end, that day that we touched on this morning, the day of visitation. And that's true, and that's the main and the best answer to the question, but it's not quite the whole truth. Because there is a sense then in which the new creation is not only future, there is a sense in which the new creation has already for us this evening begun. There is a sense in which those words spoken in the beginning, let there be light, have already now crossed God's lips in a new way, in connection with a new creation. And you all know to what I'm referring there. 2 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 6. And Paul there talks about our conversions to Christ. And he uses the language of Genesis 1:3 to describe what happened when you became a Christian. And God, as it were, said, let there be light. And he shone the light of the glory of Christ into your hearts. And so, at every conversion then, the new creation is happening. It's taking shape. It's evident. And at every conversion, God says again, as he said at the beginning, let there be light. But he says it now in a new and higher way. And so my fourth heading is the glimpse, and let there be light then. At the beginning of the old creation, it's glimpsing. It's giving us a glimpse of those words being re-spoken at the outset of every Christian life. They were re-spoken at the outset of yours and of mine. But I think those words, let there be light, they glimpse the new creation in another way too. This is the first day. That's how verse 5 ends, isn't it? The first day. It's a day on which darkness prevails, and then suddenly God intervenes and light explodes into the darkness. Surely, for those of us who know our Bibles even a little bit, surely that has to take us to another first day of the week, and to a tomb in a Jerusalem garden where darkness prevails, and then suddenly God intervenes and light explodes into the darkness, the light of resurrection, as Jesus Christ, the crucified, the corpse, the dead man, bursts into life. And truly on that day then, the new creation begins. And a darkness thicker than that primordial darkness is dispelled on Easter Sunday morning. A satanic darkness, the darkness of an evil empire. It's dispelled as God, in that quiet Jerusalem garden, says, let there be light. And so as you and I rejoice this evening, and as I've tried to lay on thick, we should rejoice this evening. As you and I rejoice in the original, let there be light, let's rejoice even more in the let there be light that rang out on that other first day of the week, that later first day of the week. We all live in the light that came about on this day in Genesis 1:3. I hope and trust and pray that all of you are living in the light that came about on that other first day of the week, the resurrection light of Jesus Christ. And if you're not, come out of the darkness into the light this evening and bask in the light that burst into existence on a quiet Sunday morning outside Jerusalem. Come to Christ. Amen. Amen.